Group meeting, Saturday, 29th October, 1983. I have tried during the last few meetings this year to present the outlook of total relationship between oneself and the world and the whole of life. Now, I have tried to do this because it is necessary to try and be free of the limitation which we all suffer from, resulting from acceptance on the one hand and rejection on the other hand. If there is total relationship, then there is nothing further to do, so to say, as far as our evolution as human beings is concerned. The human race today is still in the subhuman state. It has not realized fully what it means to be human. And as you have heard so many times before, to be human means to be the happy, or if you like, the blissful creator. Because the word human, made up of hu, H-U, and M-A-N, is derived from the Sanskrit root man, which the dictionaries will tell you means to think. But of course that's a very poor meaning indeed. We get a hint, perhaps a little more than a hint, of the true meaning of man in the Trismegistic writings, where it is said, "And God, All Father Mind, then brought forth man and fell in love with him because he was so like his sire." Which of course is partly a human presentation. I mean human in the ordinary sense of the word now. Now, it is also said that the thought in the mind of God is the creative power, or rather I should say, the formative aspect of the creative power which brings forth the universe. Now what do we mean by the thought in the mind of God? God never thinks. If you identify God with the creative energy, the supreme primordial creative energy, that energy doesn't think in anything like the sense in which we think. When I say I think, all I do is talk inaudibly. That is all I'm doing. It's a string of words all along the line. Some people say, no, I don't think verbally. I think in pictures. But how does he recognize the pictures? Apart from the description in words. And the same can be said of any other presentation. Basically, our thinking is just a stream of words. All right. The creative power, the creative energy, doesn't speak any human language. There is no vocabulary whatsoever which can express the real meaning of the thought in the mind of God which creates the universe. So, if you try and sense what it could possibly signify, it would come to this, that man means basically to create. And creation must not be mixed up with our ordinary concept of creation in the procreative sense, either biologically or culturally. All the great creations of the artists and philosophers and scientists and so forth are cultural procreations. They are not creations. Because this creation, remember, this ultimate fundamental creation, comes out of what we call nothing. But look at it this way, no thing. It is, this creative power belongs to a transcendent realm, which is so very transcendent that there must be grades and grades of being emerging from that primordial creative power, which finally produces the cosmos that we see and know and experience. So, the root man means to create in that sense. And the prefix hu, in Pali it is su, in Sanskrit it is hu, means happy. It means not only happy, it means well done. And it means having come to full fruition, come to the state of perfection. And it is associated, therefore, with the state of bliss which we ascribe to the Supreme. So the human really is one whose destiny, I would say, is to be the blissful creator. And to be the blissful creator means that this person we call the human being, who belongs to the particular animal species known as the human species, this particular being has to be free of all bondages, all limitations which prevent him from being the happy creator. Now, I don't want you to run away with the idea, therefore, that each and every human being, his and her ultimate destiny is to be like the primordial, undifferentiated creative energy. Not at all. We can't, that would be like saying that we would all be equal with God. I'm using the word God because it's such a lovely monosyllable and it is very convenient to say God than to use long phrases. All right, I don't mean that at all. I mean that within us lies this divine potentiality, so to come to our own human fulfillment in the limited context in which we exist, that we are at one, completely at one, not lost, not united in the sense of oneself with an other, but completely at one, completely united with that transcendent reality. Because in the human, it is a potentiality. In practically all the humans that have existed on the face of the globe, with the exception perhaps of a few hundred at the most, in the course of the 3 or 4 million years of human evolution, with the exception of those, all the rest have just been born, they lived, they died. And that's the end. That's the absolute end there. This is, I admit, it's a very austere outlook, a very austere presentation altogether. But unless and until each one of us realizes that there is nothing for me as a separate being to achieve, to attain, to realize, and enjoy in perpetuity, until I can see that that is the fact, then it is not possible for me really to come to fulfillment, the full intended fulfillment in the course of evolution of man. Now that is why time and again I suggest, we should look into ourselves and inquire, why do we become interested in religion and in living the religious life? I don't mean religion in the petty sense of a particular doctrine, a particular creed, a particular ritual system and worship and all the rest of it. I don't mean just that. I mean religion in this sense. Whatsoever makes for the purification of the entire psychophysical being, the whole person as we call him, whatsoever brings about that fruition, whatsoever makes for that purification of the whole person, enables him to put him in a right relationship with his whole environment, and whatsoever enables him also to sense, at least in some measure, the reality of transcendence itself, that is religion, which takes it out of the limited sphere of this, that or the other particular doctrine or belief or religious philosophy or theology or anything at all. One has to become totally free. It is only man in the entire of all the animal species existing in the world who can realize freedom in the true sense. And it is that freedom with which I am concerned. That kind of freedom. So now, if one can, one asks, how does one visualize that state of freedom? And what I am suggesting today is that if we can be wholly free of all the limitations imposed upon us by our tendency and the actual our actual life in which we accept certain things and reject other things, then we can realize that state of freedom. Because you see, if I reject anything, I am out of tune with that part of the cosmos. If I accept something, I tend to overemphasize its value. And there again, there is a state of unbalance. What is the source of acceptance and rejection? It is our pleasure-pain mechanism. Something pleases us, we accept it. Something displeases us, we reject it. But what we accept may be not acceptable to somebody else. What we reject may not be rejected by other people, may be accepted by other people. So that acceptance and rejection both bring us to a state of disharmony. If we are free of all acceptance and all rejection, in the ordinary sense of the term, that is to say, in the sense of preferential choice, if we exercise preferential choice, which is born of our personal likes and dislikes, our pleasure satisfaction and our displeasure prevention, if we live according to that, well, we shall never be in harmony within ourselves or with the world. You see, all the efforts which people make in the political, economic, educational, social, and various other spheres, they are all doomed to failure, for the very simple reason that the fundamental consciousness at work underlying all those efforts is not a consciousness, a clear consciousness of the reality of the totality. There is only one total reality. The totality is the reality. All right. But am I conscious in terms of totality, or am I conscious in terms of myself as befriending this, that and the other, or this, that and the other person, and as rejecting this, that and the other? You see, there is not that real consciousness of totality. If there were that real consciousness of totality, one's whole thinking and feeling process, one's words and one's action would naturally and spontaneously express in perfect beauty, express perfectly that consciousness of totality. This is very important. I think I have said enough to suggest this sort of general view as regards this total relationship with the whole of life. Now, let us see what happens and what has happened and what is happening and probably will continue to happen for a few more million years. Science, religion, and the newspapers. Now, don't laugh. They have, all of them, have at least one unhappy effect upon our, upon the whole course of our lives. Because we become enslaved by the authority of the scientist, the religious teacher, and the media. Observe how people will converse about some matter or other. Oh, but it is scientifically proved that this is so. All right, this is so. And it is fixed forever, this is so. There's no escape from it. But look at the history of science. It started with sheer speculation, armchair speculation. They happened to hit off, by chance, one or two bright ideas. For example, the atomic theory. In China, in India, a few decades before the same thing happened in Greece with Democritus, and I think also Leucippus, they hit upon the idea of the atomic theory, that the universe was made up of various atoms. Of course, their atoms were not hydrogen, oxygen, gold, silver, and so on. They were atoms of earth, air, fire, water. Those were their fundamental elements, and those were the atoms. And by various combinations and permutations and so forth, the whole universe came into being. That was their idea. Well, it prevailed for many, many centuries, extraordinarily long period of time. And then, of course, with the rise of experimental science, especially with the work of people like Roger Bacon, and then after him Francis Bacon and others, the whole idea of experimentation came up. And with experimentation you could discover this, that and the other and so forth. And finally, the atomic theory was once again accepted, but in a totally different form. The different elements which compose the stuff of the universe, all of them, 92, which were the elements that nature itself had brought into being. The Big Bang brought all that into being, ultimately. The 92 elements were all composed of atoms. And these atoms were described in modern times till the end of the, practically till the end of the 19th century, and certainly in the olden days in India, China, and in Greece, as being created by God. I think Newton himself used that sort of terminology, and certainly Descartes did. created by God, they were invisible, they were indestructible, they were infinitely small, that's why they were invisible. And they were indestructible, eternal, as long as God willed that the universal process shall go on. And then when God willed that it should be otherwise, he drew the whole universe back into himself. And that was the end of the life of the atoms. Pretty long life, agreed. But even so, there was an end to that. The modern, atomic theory, as it flourished till the end of the last century, did postulate that the atoms were indestructible, that they were the ultimate building blocks of the universe. And at the end of the century, it was various experiments showed that the atoms were not indivisible. And as you know, during the first quarter of the of our present century, they discovered that the atoms were composed of protons, electrons, neutrons, and then it was discovered that the neutrons were actually a proton and an electron completely united. That's why the neutron was neutral, because the proton was positively charged, the electron was negatively charged, and so on. And so, science went on removing the old ideas about the fundamental nature of things, one by one. And in this century, still scientists try to look for the fundamental building blocks, till they discovered that there was no such thing but interrelationships only between energies. There was no such thing as a particular something, a definite something, like something which you can pick up with your fingers, which formed the fundamental stuff of the universe. That the universe actually consisted of relationships between innumerable energies. That is all. See? So now, when a person says, oh, but it is scientifically proved that this is so, you can be pretty certain that the time will come when this will not be so, but something else. Now the same thing has happened in the sphere of religion. People say, but the Lord himself declared this. The classic examples are the Buddha supports rebirth and karma as popularly understood. Now note, as popularly understood. Maybe that the Buddha did support that. But the words he used, I feel, have been misunderstood and misrepresented. We won't go into details at the moment. We may consider that later. When we talk about rebirth, what or who is reborn? People will say, oh, my immortal soul, the divine spark in me, etc., etc. What is this immortal soul? What is the divine spark? Can you take the ultimate power which creates everything and say that its context functions in the same way as the context of that which is perishable? Our ordinary context is finite, it is temporal, it is mortal. Everything can be measured, everything has a beginning, a proceeding, and an ending. That is our ordinary context. Now, if you try to sense, to become conscious, even in the tiniest degree of transcendence, you will find that the context of transcendence is the infinite, the eternal, the immortal. Now, if you can, you'll have to brood over this in the quiet, meditate in the true sense. When the organism, the psychophysical organism, is very quiet and peaceful, then just let the brain calm down and stop talking. Let the brain stop talking. And then if you can sense, if you do happen to be fortunate enough to get the sense of the infinite and the eternal, you will find that it cannot be split up. It is a totality. It is the absolute. And I have said, without any hesitation, that the miracle that we can see and understand ultimately is just this. Every single thing that is finite and temporal is pervaded, is the materialization of the totality, which is the infinite and the eternal. It is not as if a spark of the divine is inside me, or you, or inside this stool, or this microphone. The whole of it is inside every little thing throughout the universe. Now, can you picture it? You see, the brain is completely defeated there. You have to experience it in consciousness, in inner consciousness. It will come. If you let it come, you can't say, oh, I want to experience this which Firoz Mehta was talking of. You won't. You'll never experience that which Firoz Mehta is talking about. You will experience the actuality, the reality, if you're fortunate enough to get to that state. And it will not be something which I am talking about. And at the same time, it will also be completely related to what I'm talking about. So you see, when we talk about rebirth, and you naturally inquire, what is reborn? You are thinking all the time in terms of something permanent, which is reborn. There is nothing permanent which is reborn. But there is this. Transcendence manifests itself perpetually through space and time, expressing its own infinity and eternity in countless ways. That's all. That's what happens. If you want to speak of anybody being reborn, it is the transcendent which is born and moves out from one manifestation into another perpetually. Not you or I. You or I, we are conscious of ourselves as separate somethings. That is how we are conscious. Look deeply into the state of mind which is present when you try to peer into these mysteries. We are something. I am the I am I. As and when we reach that state where we can transcend the egoic state of consciousness, then we have the opportunity in our lifetime to realize the unity consciousness state, the one single consciousness, And you will realize, if it ever happens, that there is no such thing as my consciousness, or my divine spark, or my soul. Anything which is limited to me. The totality functions, manifests and functions through all limitations. That is how manifestation can come into being. By transcendence constricting itself. Therefore, all the actual statements, theological, philosophical and so forth, they are all right for a limited time and in a limited situation. That is all. The Buddha may have said, and as a matter of fact he has, as far as the printed teachings go, he says, now Ananda, that is not to be understood in that way, but in this way. I was so and so, Yasodhara was the lady in question, you were so and so in this particular event and so forth. And any serious Buddhist may say, but good gracious me, you are contradicting the Buddha, what nonsense. How dare you? I do. When there is the consciousness of a Buddha present, it is not his personal consciousness. If John Smith is a Buddha, has reached Buddhahood, he is no longer John Smith. His consciousness is completely at one with the total consciousness. And when he is at one with that total consciousness, whosoever was, is, or will be, is included in that consciousness. Therefore, it's perfectly legitimate to say, I was so-and-so, or I will be so-and-so, provided that the will be does come off. I think you better shoot me for being such a terrible heretic. But there it is. Don't be afraid of heresy. The right sort of heresy. The heresy which comes about as a result of exploring, inquiring, investigating with an open mind, with a free mind. I have no vested interest, personally, I have no vested interest in any doctrine or any dogma or teaching or anything at all. And therefore, I can quietly look into the thing and see what I can see. When you yourself are able to be in that state where you sense this lightning of transcendence, whereby the totality is realized in every single particular throughout the universe, you will find an extraordinary bliss enveloping you. And in your daily life, an extraordinary freedom from the wrong type of reaction to whatsoever happens anywhere at any time. So, you see, that is again where religion produces an unhappy result with us. It deprives us of our freedom of mind, the freedom to investigate. And so forth. This has been said by the great teacher, by the supreme teacher, therefore it is true forever and ever. Nothing is true forever and ever in that sense. Simply because the sense in which we use that term is the context of the finite and the temporal. And in the context of the finite and temporal, everything is mortal, everything dies, everything gives place to something else. Is this too awful? To me, it is life in the transcendent sense. And then consider that third thing I mentioned, newspapers, the media. Punishment for our evil doing, which produced media. But I saw it in the papers. It must be true. See how the mind is blocked. It was there in the papers. It was given out in the news. Is it true? Take, say, political matters. And you know what goes on in the cabinet and all the rest of it. For 30 years, is it, or 50 years? Is it 50 years before the thing is published? 30 years. And 30 years afterwards, when it is published, most, if not all, that was said in the newspapers is found to be false. And yet, we, intelligent, educated human beings, will say, oh, but I saw it in the papers. It must be true. And I react accordingly. So you see, the implication of being human. The human being can realize the same freedom which eternal God knows, experiences. But in order to be free like that, we have to examine everything with a completely open mind. Yes, what is said, what is affirmed, may be along such lines as leads to a deeper truth, but no more than that. Usually, it has elements in it which definitely are false and which would have to be rejected. Now, I said rejected. But look, that is not a rejection which is the result of dislike or antipathy on my part. When you see that something is false, it naturally moves out of your life. If you really see, that is the point. I mean rejection in that sense, in a transcendent sense almost. You see, it dissolves away altogether. Now, one last point this evening. Have you noticed how all that the great spiritual teachers taught has as their foundation, as its foundation, ethic? Why ethic? Apart from the fact that it is indispensable for the evolution of our own consciousness till it reaches its culmination in being able to sense the transcendent. Apart from that, why ethic? Ethic has the most powerful influence in social relations. Relations with your husband, your wife, your parents, your children, your friends, your employers, your employees, and so forth. The great teachers were concerned with helping mankind to realize the happy society, the fulfilled society. No one person can be fulfilled and happy and so forth, cut off from the rest of humanity. It has to include all humanity. Those teachers were socialists in the transcendent sense. Now, what do I mean by they were socialists? Nothing to do with anything that masquerades under the name of socialism in the world today or has masqueraded. Doesn't mean anything like that. The socialist is a person who is free of the limitations of self-centered self-consciousness and is conscious in terms of not you and you and I and him and her, but in terms of us, the totality, in terms of humanity. Now that is a socialist. Because there is only one society in the world, and that is the whole of the human race. You see? The whole of the human race. And in order to release that state of consciousness of the totality of the human race, the real social consciousness as such, ethic is absolutely necessary. The person who is devoid of transcendent love, don't talk of love in the ordinary possessive sense and so forth, but of transcendent love, wisdom, goodness, purity, beauty. If a person has those things, he can be a socialist in the true sense. And thereby, he is one who is a savior of humanity. A savior in this sense. To save is the same as to salve. To salve means to heal. He's a healer of humanity. See, that's why we have teachings like love thy neighbor as thyself. Well, what is my neighbor? The whole of the environment. Bricks, mortar, stones, people, mosquitoes, everything is my neighbor. Everything altogether. And if I have a sense of separation from that, this or that thing or person, I am not a social being. And I cannot help him or her. You have to have that transcendent love and wisdom. And then you or I will never try to put the world right. Because if that consciousness functions, then the world inevitably gets right by itself. It happens. And that is salvation, if you like. So you see, to present this sort of thing, I naturally have to be free of all the limitations imposed through the ordinary type of acceptance and rejection in the world. You may ask, won't you reject evil? I don't need to reject evil in the sense that I shall be an antagonist against evil and try to destroy it to annihilate it. Not in that sense. But if I see that this is evil, and this is not conducive to the fulfillment of the human race, to realize humanity, then it will naturally fall off from me. And if I haven't antagonism to anything or anybody, then I can really help it. But if I harbor hate, feeling of revenge or a feeling that, oh, I have nothing to do with this, then I can't do anything about it, of course. So, it's very, very difficult, I admit. Supremely difficult. But then, try and write Shakespeare. Can you? I can't. Thank you.